I'd like to give a talk called Fire and Food. Gautama Buddha gives more than one talk about learning how to feel. Learning how to feel that something is burning us. For myself, I heard this teaching first when I was studying religion in college. And maybe that's why the image came across to me as kind of lame. So the teaching is to learn that we're holding a hot coal, so that once we can feel that we're holding the hot coal, we'll drop it naturally. There's even much more vivid teachings and images that are given, where there's someone with leprosy being carried towards a fire, a pit of burning coals. Can you hear okay in this room? Okay. And because of the disease of the skin, the leprosy, there's some feeling that the heat of this pit of fire and coals is somehow soothing. It's like better than the leprosy itself. It's not that it actually helps the disease or anything. And so practicing, we practice towards being able to feel that even if it seems to give some kind of relief, to be held over a pit of coals seems to give some kind of relief, that actually it's painful and causing further damage. And in this kind of story that time and again comes in the teachings of Gautama Buddha, I find it has a certain sense of humor, like a certain Monty Python kind of sense of humor. Do you know who Monty Python is? People who are younger than a certain age might not. And just the amount of detail that's given about how the person with leprosy would actively resist once we start to realize how painful it is to be held over a fire. We would actively resist being dragged to the fire. But then in our normal way of living, we would agree to be held over a pit of fire because it gives some kind of relief. So I find the strange story of the leper in the pit of fire to be strange enough to get our attention, to be more interested. To me, the image of, oh, notice that you're holding a burning coal and you'll drop it, as a kind of teaching to get over our attachments, wasn't strange enough for me. It didn't make me take it in deeply. But to think of someone willingly or unwillingly being pulled towards a pit of fire got my attention. What I've noticed kind of more clearly recently is that we are used to living in a way that's as if we're burnt inside. And it seems normal to us. We're really dry and incredibly sensitive and tender and reactive because it's like all burnt inside us. And it feels normal. And so I found that this image of fire and being burnt is not just a kind of vivid metaphor, but a really accurate description of what our experience is inside in a subtle level. the way that we live kind of ruled by deep insecurity and by other people's rules. And by not knowing what's going on, but thinking that we need to pretend that we have some clue. And this leaves us dried out and red and irritated. And it's so much like a leper being held over a pit of fire. So I'm surprised often by how accurate these strange stories sometimes end up being. It's not just a good, vivid image to get our attention, but it actually well describes us. The way that we mostly live now where we kind of take things upside down. We take what's important as something that should be left till the end of the day or the end of the list. And what's unimportant, we do first. We take the simple, direct, kind of intuitive, direct line of communication that we have with life. We take that as silly, invalid. And we take every other voice first as advice. So practice is available for us that we can follow through with our practice, so that we can go from our current state where we actually can't bear the truth. We can't actually eat nourishment. But there is practice that's available so that we can not just bear the truth, but we can eat it. As we are now, we enjoy pretense, we enjoy limitation, we enjoy working on our negativity, we enjoy gossiping. We enjoy restlessness. Even though it burns us, it kind of burns us out. At least it does burn us out. Like, at least at some point we can't continue that game. At least there really is an actual need for nourishment that comes through and kind of pops up sometimes. And so sometimes we are ready to leave behind our previous way of being, of living, of behaving. And it's important when we're ready to leave behind what hasn't worked, what hasn't suited us, what hasn't fed us, what has burned us. It's important to know that the general practices that we talk about in a group only go so far. And then you are left with a kind of gap. So there are the really general practices of calming the mind, of resting, so kind of some kind of replenishment, some kind of soothing of what's been burnt. Some kind of remembering of love and aliveness. And it's not actually that it's vague after that. Like, there's what's basically generally useful for most people that we can talk about openly in a group, and that gets talked about more and more now. Mindfulness and kindness, love. Practices with the body like yoga and qigong. Things that are generally useful. But pretty soon, we get to the end of the map. We get to the end of what can be generally useful. And it's easy to then think that it's kind of vague and unknowable or unknown or something after that. And so we get kind of vague. And that's not the situation. The situation is we do those general practices whenever they're needed, whether we're a beginner or experienced or whatever. We do practices that help bring relief from the busy mind by focusing it on something, or by connecting our superficial mind with our deep wish. May all beings be happy, may I be happy. We do what is right for the body with food and movement. And all of that also keeps on evolving. We keep learning through our experience. But that is definitely not the end of the story. It's hardly the beginning. So what comes from there is really specific to each individual. It's not at all vague, but it can't be in the books because it's specific to you. It's specific to you now. And it partly can come out of your own past experience, what you learned by doing the general techniques, feeling the breath when your mind is busy, leaving it more open when your mind is not busy, for example. What comes out of that, we could almost catch the flow, but we don't have the confidence, we don't have the experience to get it as exact as it needs to be, usually. There are a few people that were given or were born with that confidence to just catch the breeze and know how to fly straight away. But most of us need some help. So talking to teachers, talking to yourself as your teacher too, and just openly asking for help to from wherever to whoever are some of the ways that you can start to at least know where to, which few lines you want to experiment with. So I have that, the poem that I kind of butchered the first night, and I put up the first part of it on the board. You were made for joy, child. The feet of you were carved for that. The ankles of you run for that. The rise of rain, the shift of the wind, the drop of a red star on a far water rim. An endless catalog of shouts, laughters, silent contemplations. They made you from day to day for a joy, child. So already here, there's some indication, and I find it lovely and strange to have it in a poem by someone who may or may never have meditated. So any specialness of being a meditator can just drop away. It's a human situation that we can discover what's needed. And so Carl Sandburg, from somewhere, uncovered this possibility that things that came out of us unexpectedly in a shout or in laughter, or it happened in a silent contemplation. There was silence and there was something that fell into place. Those happenings made us ready for our specific, not at all vague, next step into thin air. From that kind of tried and true ground of calming the mind, letting the quality of loving to love start to come through, the kind of basic practices. From that nest, There is a calling to step into thin air. There's something in us that wants to. And it's a child, and it's made for joy. And day by day, it gets more and more ready. And then suddenly, in the next part of the poem, there's a little break, but it's the same poem. Suddenly, the voice isn't speaking to you. The voice is speaking to him, or about him. And so, I wasn't sure how to write it on paper because of my own wish to leave the poem as it is and my own wish to have it be for all of us and not only the he's, as my son calls it, the he's and the she's. So the poem goes, well, so just after that, they made you from day to day for joy, child. And there's just one line of space, and then immediately, well, he sat up and said to himself, so we sit up and say to ourselves, this is good. I will go to it. This is where some people, but most of us don't, have the confidence to just feel, this is good, I will go to it. And so we're here to uncover that feeling capacity, this is good. It's not right or wrong, it has a feeling of basic goodness. And I will go to it. It's not just in a special little cone of light over there or something. I will go to it. And I love the wording that he used, I will go to it. It means, like, I'll get on with it, but also, I will go to it. Like, I'm going to be that. I'm going to go over there. If it's not coming to me, I'm going over there. I will go to it. He sat up and said to himself, this is good. I will go to it. So something in us, when there's that possibility of being made for joy by what's already happened, no matter what else has happened, there have been shouts and laughters and silent contemplations in all of our lives. And they have made us ready for now. And something in us does, well, sit up and does say to ourselves, this is good. I will go to it. And something else says, yeah, but after the retreat, this is a meditation retreat, for example, or after my trip to India, or after my trip to Saptal, or after my thesis, or whatever. So something that sits up and says to us, this is good, I will go to it, and doesn't buy into the hesitation. We don't go too far either side. We don't say, I will go to it, and kind of F everybody. I'm going to just ignore everything else in my life. I'm going to stop eating. I'm just going to go to it. No, that's unnecessary drama, usually. Some days it's not. Some days we go without meals because we're going to it, and that's how it is. But most days we also have breakfast, and we might wash someone else's dishes as well as our own. But we don't go to it only after we've done everything else either. Sometimes it comes first, sometimes it comes second, but it doesn't go last. There's another image from the Buddha that's beautiful of a mother cow and her baby calf. She keeps grazing, and she keeps the calf within sight, safe from the edges, near the milk. But she keeps eating the whole day. Her head is in the grass the whole time. This is good, I will go to it. Till then, he had been, we had been, you had been satisfied with yourself. So here we come again onto important and insecure kind of ground. Until then, we had been satisfied with ourselves. Our current way of talking about ourselves, we wouldn't put it this way. We would be much more aware of our self-criticism and our self-hatred as a main player for almost everyone that I know. And this is where I'll venture to say something that can be disturbing or on certain days wrong, but there's a certain way that even the whole thing of hating myself and criticizing myself all the time is an escape. It's something I'd rather be occupied with than facing the whole unknownness of my life and the power of aliveness. It's a terrible fire, the self-hatred and self-criticism that usually is going on in almost everyone I know, most of the day and most of the night, asleep and awake. But it's an occupation that's demanding, but also very fascinating. And it keeps us occupied as it burns us. And it keeps our energy tied up, so that there's not energy left over, no loose ends floating around that could be feeling out anything else but myself. So we might rather say, till then we had been occupied with ourselves, with the smallness of ourselves, with the wrongness of ourselves, or right and wrong. But I also want to mention that as a main practice, really practicing, lifting off the load of self-hatred and self-criticism, really disbelieving that, and at the same time noticing how it is so often tied to a kind of corresponding arrogance that we usually would notice less, most people would notice less. Some people who are into psychology would say it's equal. We give more importance, we give more weight, we give more power to the self-criticism. But it's important to just notice if there might be more putting myself up than I realize. Because I feel the putting down so much. I might not notice, or I might feel like I've earned this putting myself up part. And both are so far from what's interesting and important in our lives. As we start to get to know the freedom of putting aside the putting myself down, we get to know the feeling of the put down. Not good enough, never going to meditate, etc. Never be free, whatever. Never get over this anger, never get over this fear, whatever. Starting to get to know the hollowness and the burning of it, the untrueness of it, the kind of, let's say, what's the word, fast food kind of feeling of it. It does give a kind of jolt of energy that does have a crash. Then we might be able to catch the other side and just feel the hollowness and just let that whole machine go more often. Does that make sense? Do you have any questions so far? Or comments?
Can you just repeat again after like what's left from the, when you let go of both the putting up and the putting down?
Yeah, I don't think I said, but I'm happy to say it. Yeah, that's where I'd like to go now. And it's a really good question because it's not really what we usually expect. So we might not think we expect anything because it's so unknown territory. But when we do have the chance to put aside or let it fall apart, up, down, right, wrong. What I've said so far about it is that this is good, I will go to it. So there is something left that has a goodness that our system responds to as good. And there is a sitting up and saying to ourselves and a going. And leaving behind that kind of, the poet calls satisfaction with ourselves, with himself. That kind of sense of, well, this is the best I can do. At best, this is the best I can do, kind of small, the sense of being small as an escape. So that's when our specific individual line of practice or lines of practices start to be vivid for us. So I think I'd like to say more about what's left. I first want to just have us notice and acknowledge how many resources, how much energy, how much time from all of us and from other people has already gone in to make this week possible. And if you would know how much Jonathan has done or how much the ashram has even done, converting this used to be an old barn with fleas and everything. that was what we used last time as the hall a few years ago. Into this, which was quite a whole political, what's the word? Gristly. Gristly is like not easy to chew. Kind of process for this to happen. Basically, mostly for us to be able to come back here. I think that we're shy to accept that much of resources, time, energy, care, to just be here doing nothing. And I think it's important, be shy, that's fine, but also acknowledge that that had to go in or this wouldn't be. And that starts to kind of wiggle something inside that this is that important. This leaving room, leaving of room for something else, for some other ways, is that important? For someone to spend, let's say, like maybe 100 hours on the computer when he'd rather be hiking in the mountains. And not like coming to charge us for it, but really because we're doing this, he wants to do that. That's Jonathan. That's a real example, not theoretical. And so it's not like you or I have to be a special person to deserve that much care. There's this really, really beautiful impersonalness. Because we're human beings who are willing to be here and find out what happens, other people are willing to put all of this care for us as real individual people who aren't somebody else. It's not like just a cutout figure. It's you're a real person, I'm a real person. But not because we're special. So feeling the importance and the need, like it's actually needed that there's a place that we could come to. And there are so few places that we could come to, actually, if you start to look around for a place for a retreat. Where we're allowed to lie down, where we're allowed to do nothing. And even if it is a bit of a battle here that we're lying down, we are allowed to be here, to lie down, to not be doing a particular religious tradition, to not follow someone else's rules. If we can kind of let that a little bit shyness or discomfort of, I'm not sure if I can live up to that, or that's too much. It kind of starts to wiggle down into place where it's good. It is needed. It's just a simple human need. We don't have to be special to deserve it. We don't have to do something outrageous and visible to prove that we're worth it. But just accepting that it's needed. And it's not just needed for you in your personal life, it's needed that people do this. This thing that's general in the beginning, there's these things that are generally useful for most people, and then there's this stepping off out of the nest and finding in the wilderness what foods you need to eat that maybe no one else needs to eat. So one thing that's left when we let go of our busyness with up and down, which I'm not saying it's easy at all. It is like in the story of the leper and the fire, like at least two strong people are dragging you towards the fire. And something in you knows that at first that will seem like it feels good to be held over a fire. The self-criticism and the self over aggrandizement, so the self-upping, trying to be special, trying to get recognition. Has a grip on us. Even when we know that it hurts, it still grabs us, and it's stronger than us. But what's left, in along with something that sits up and starts talking to us and says, this is good, and let's go. Even if what was good, what came before was also good, now we're going over here. It's another kind of fire that remains. And that when it has more space, gets more oxygen, we can feel it more. And this is the fire that refines us. It refines our feeling capacity. We can feel what burns us. We can feel what's a disease. We can feel what's dragging us where we don't want to go. And it really helps, I would say, like to cook our experience so that we can eat it in a way that brings out what's true. We can bear the truth of things. We can bear the truth of aliveness. It's a fire in us. In the poem, till then we had been satisfied with ourselves. Now there came back an old unrest. Till then, we'd been occupied with ourselves. But when we start to feel, this is good, I will go to it, something sits up and says that to us and takes us by the hand. And we're a child, and we're made for joy, so we're like, okay, right. Maybe. Maybe there's another way. Then we might be surprised to find that now there comes back, an old unrest. And I love this word on a deep rest retreat, unrest. So it's not restlessness. It's not being dragged where we don't want to go, that's not good for us. But on a deep rest retreat, we might expect to just rest and rest more and get more and more replenished and plumped up and juicy. And so when the old unrest comes back, we might push it aside. So, but don't, please don't. So we continue to do the basic practices, calming the mind, so focusing the mind on something when it's really distracted, not focusing it on something when it is already calm and open and peaceful, not tying it to a leash when it's quiet. Doing whatever starts to bring out what loves to love in you. And then as you also start to make your own experiments, finding your own lines of investigating, querying, what is aliveness? What is this? What is life? What am I? Not just busying ourselves with the techniques that are known, but leaving room for discovery of our own way, of our own, through our own openness and leaving room what happens. So not just hurrying and trying to keep up with the technique. So we're trying to be with the breath and maybe 1 in 10 out-breaths we feel half of, and we think, I better hurry and get better at this, and then I'll be myself, or then I'll feel my way. If we can acknowledge how hard it is to do the basic general techniques, that the mind typically wanders a lot. So even if I'm just, so-called just, being with the breath or the feet or the belly or the back, I'm hardly there or here. So how much more subtle and challenging is the really specific practice that grows out of that? So accepting and acknowledging that, not pushing ourselves along, still leaving room for the basic techniques and what else comes through. And sometimes what else comes through that's more authentic, more genuinely coming from all the shouts and laughters and silent contemplations of your life that made you ready for your first step, kind of. It's like your first real step. It actually might end up not being harder than following your breath, because you're 100% there. Even if it's much more subtle and if we think about it as in an adult way too much, we couldn't trust. But if we catch ourselves in a childlike moment that we go with it, it might be something that you remember from childhood, looking at the clouds, or you remember from a dream. If you give yourself permission to follow through on that experiment, and it really rhymes or rings true for you, then you get the feeling of, it is good, I will go to it. And not only I will go to it, but I'm in it. Now there came back an old unrest. So there's been a line from the poet that's interesting, not always relevant here, but now there came back an old unrest carried over from a grandfather as was, the one grandfather we had failed to live up to. We could take this sometimes literally, or we can take it more like wisdom in ourselves that we've been ignoring, that has been ignored, that was too strict or rigorous. That would be like, it seemed too hard for us to live up to when we saw ourselves as so small, and so we ignored it. Or that grandfather, more likely, that was really weird, and we wanted to just pretend we didn't have. But when we're honest inside, we just didn't want to live up to that. We didn't want to live up to that really upright, weird, eccentric, human being, authentic kind of living. But somehow we can't quite forget what we wanted to forget, and so it comes as an old unrest, comes back. It's kind of lovely to think of that place of honesty in ourselves, or potential honesty in ourselves, as an ancestor, even if it isn't literally for you, related to an ancestor that you know of. An ancestor who maybe blesses you whether you want it or not. An ancestor who has more life experience to go on than we do. And that just so naturally, deeply naturally, something wants to live up to that. And then what happens in the poem? The old unrest, and then the grandfather. He had a hunch, you had a hunch, a new hunch, and another. Instead of ideas, whims, he had hunches, we had hunches. So a whim is not only just an idea, which an idea could be really serious, but a whim is like, oh, if we're supposed to do what our heart wants, then I just feel like going on a walk around the lake or whatever. And going on a walk around the lake could be a really important first step. But it's up to us. So that's when we get off the map. It's up to us to feel the quality of that movement. Is it what's needed? Or is it childish rather than childlike? Is it childish in the sense of getting small again? Instead of ideas, whims, we had hunches. And so he said, this is good, I will go to it. So almost the only echo between the first stanza and the second stanza of the poem is that in the first one, the poet repeats, you were made for joy, child, the first line and the second line. And in the second stanza, near the beginning, this is good, I will go to it. And again at the end, this is good, I will go to it. And so just feeling that being made for joy and this is good, I will go to it, as kind of holding or carrying all the other process involved. This will be on the board to look at if you want later. And so as we open to practice, letting go of our ideas of practice and our kind of whims about practice. So there might be a whim in practice where I'm going to sit up all night. That could come sometimes from a really authentic place, but it's more likely an idea or a whim that we've heard somewhere and it sounds kind of fiery and intense and cool. More likely, if we're opening to our practice, that would just happen rather than be something we decide to do. And that's one way we can feel a bit the difference. A real suggestion from that place that knows what's good and is willing to go to it. It can come in an idea. There can be an idea along with the real suggestion. It's not that if it comes in the thinking mind, it's off. But more often, things would just happen, and later we would be able to describe them. When something comes in an idea, maybe we need to have that idea in mind because we're crossing such a strong habit energy or internalized rule. And so if the idea isn't there, we don't have the confidence, we tremble, we shake, we fall apart in the face of that heat, that friction. And so here we have the kind of what holds practice together, like the two sides. If we really feel for the heart of practice, it's like being at the gate of form, of the formless, formless, being without form. So form, when we speak of form in meditation practice, then there are forms of practice, like being in silence, being on a retreat, lying down or sitting, following the breath, cultivating love or friendship. Those are forms. And as we relate to practice, we need to remember that forms of practice, at the heart of them, keep us at the gate of the formless. And so our loyalty is not to the form. Our interest is not even really in the form, except for what that brings out. We can let the form, therefore, get really intricate and really strong looking, or really loose and almost nothing. It really doesn't matter per se, it's each individual's path to find that. But to take on or take ourselves into or take into ourselves a form of practice that's about being at the gate or the edge of formlessness is a really different kind of endeavor from what happens anywhere else in our lives. One way that practicing has to do with formlessness, is the way that practice has to do with letting go. And we could go into this in like really intimate detail. Slowly, so maybe we will over a couple of days in the talks. But even if we think of feeling the out-breath happen, there's not just the fact of the letting go of the air that the body does, but the quality of receiving that experience continually has the quality of letting go, rather than holding on. As soon as there's a whisper of holding on, we're no longer with the experience. And by the way, it's one of the beautiful things about feeling the out-breath as a practice, because it is a letting go. It is a physical letting go, biological and energy letting go. And the quality of that physical expression, letting go, that quality of letting go can actually start to infuse you as you let the letting go happen in a letting go way. As we learn by practicing to receive in a letting go way, the communication with our experience gets intense. It's so nourishing that it's shocking. We're so used to eating and not being nourished. We're so used to, both literally and metaphorically. I have a kind of weird Gautam Buddha Monty Python kind of gross example that comes to my mind, that for a while, some of my friends were into wheatgrass fasting, and they would go to this wheatgrass juice center and drink shots of wheatgrass and do all kinds of ways of having wheatgrass come into your body. And the lining of the intestine would apparently get so clean that whatever food they ate after that as they came out of the fast just would actually get absorbed for the first time in, you know, however many years since they'd done their last wheatgrass fast. So they needed less food, and what they ate made a really big difference to them, what the quality of the food was, etc. And this is what it's like when we start to leave our experience as it is and leave us as we are and let that not be a separate thing, but let that come together. That's another thing that happens, like what's left something sits up and knows what's good and goes. And that's an expression of this other kind of fire. And as we let that other kind of fire move us, our sensitivity gets refined. And we actually need less, so there's not neediness. And what's left is just need. There's not the game of neediness. There's just what's needed, and what's needed gets met naturally. There's the way that practice is about staying at the kind of gate of the formless, so staying not loyal to form or formless, really. Playfully with both, kind of powerfully with both, the confidence that both are, form and formless, are true in their own ways. And unproblematically, not different also. With practice as letting go, there's this curious way that part of the letting go would be like actually more and more efficiently feeling how and where to focus our energy and our attention. So that sounds like a holding on. But the where and how to focus is this letting go quality that still stays, not because I'm holding on to something. So some other force is at work. That is kind of, we can get into tune with that force that can stay tuned without holding on. We can't control that force the way that we could start to kind of do mind control. But we can get attuned to that force that stays efficiently, steadily focused. And the quality is letting go quality. There's a sense of relief because we're not buying into the whole boring down, up, right, wrong, getting burnt again thing. In the refining that happens along the way, as we get attuned to that other force, that other fire, there is another kind of burning that happens, another kind of heat. And it's up to us, in our own experience, to learn to feel the difference. And to feel how a childlike, underneath kind of aliveness that loves this fire of aliveness and clearly recognizes like the burning pit of coal fire for the leper kind of burning, like what? That childlike what? That starts to come more clearly. We're less easily fooled by ourselves. And so then in the practice, we could talk about the way it happens from the inside out or from down up, and the way it happens kind of from the outside in or from the top down. So we try to do what seems best to us, and so we use our will, our personal will, to break through habit energies. We try to disbelieve the self-criticism or the self-upping. We try to bring our attention back to something simple. And as we do, we also leave room for some kind of relief or the yes, the deep agreement with the simplicity. So from the outside in, we're kind of picking away at our habits. We're kind of slowly working and it seems impossible. It seems like one of those folk tales where the heroine or the hero has to go through a pile of grain and find the one grain that's got the name of God written on it or whatever. It seems impossible if we would watch ourselves. So I recommend don't watch yourself. Just keep going. Even if it looks like a mountain of grain and you're going one by one, don't watch yourself. Just keep going. What else is there to do, actually? At least you're just going grain by grain more often and you're not like reinforcing the habit energies as much. But it's good to know, let me state it more strongly, it will seem impossible, it will seem like you don't have enough patience, it will seem like it's not worth having patience because there's just no way. But you just keep going. That's the working down from top down, outside in, where we're consciously doing our job kind of thing. And we're kind of picking away at the habit energies, and we're also kind of practicing filling up the gaps or the wounds with love, with care, with being present, with letting life come to those places that we know of where we feel like a hole or a gap or a lack. This is also conscious practice that I'm doing, and it is as if from the outside in, I'm kind of applying this to myself. I'm doing this to myself. And that seems like all that we're doing, and it does seem like it's not really enough. But luckily, it's not all that's happening. Somehow, there is also this from the inside out or from the unconscious up. That something is naturally given permission to grow and come into place. And it does, and we don't know it, and we might not know it for decades. So this is where it's really worth having the patience doing your seemingly small little impossible folktale task. And when you finish the first mound of grains, then there's always the second one. And someday we get a glimpse or we end up living in that grew while we were busy. Are there any questions before we stop for the evening?
Sometimes when we're in this state, or I'll use that word, it seems that good things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because the mind has changed? Or I mean, it's almost like you know, if we believe in deism, it's almost that God is helping somehow.
I think I would put it differently. There do seem to be times, like that we could say times of grace, like there are periods of time that we feel open and happy and things more easily seem to fall into place. And then if we would make too much of a logical conclusion out of that, I think we'll get into problems. Whereas this part in us that can say, this is good, I will go to it, it can feel the goodness even when things are not going the way we hoped. And it can go to it even when it's like a wall of fire. And we don't see ourselves as having the resources to cross it. There's still a sense of the goodness, even when the circumstances are bad. I do think there is something in what you're saying that when we start to let there be less and less unnecessary thinking, and we start to catch when the thinking takes over or goes in a weird direction. And even more when we start to talk from there, when we start to see how that actually influences events. And there's less and less unnecessary thinking and unnecessary talking from that thinking. Then there's a lot more room for things to not get unnecessarily weird and painful. And so I think there's something in what you're saying, but I wouldn't like lock it in too much. But there is a lot of unnecessary suffering from just believing our thinking, and then even more when we communicate from there. And that has a real impact on events and people, including ourselves. And so the openness and coming from the hunch instead of the idea or the whim can have a real impact on the world, inner, outer.
It seems like that one big part of this is the giving up.
Yeah.
Is the surrendering.
Yeah. Especially giving up that whole kind of mantle of trying too hard and trying to be good or whatever. So that there's actually energy to do what's needed and to receive what's needed and to leave room for everything else.
And yet it's so gradual. Isn't it? Or is it? It seems to me gradual.
It's so unpredictable, I would say.
Yeah.
It's so not what we had planned. I think any time we try to say what it is, it'll... Even that's saying too much, but... I think it's best if we kind of plan for gradual, but be ready for sudden. Because we want it to be quick, and we would take quick as a kind of like a compliment. So if we can be prepared for gradual, then if we're really prepared for gradual, then maybe we won't interfere when sudden. Because the sudden is often, it's the discovery of what is can happen suddenly. Like the discovery of what's been gradually growing for 40 years can be sudden also. And also when things are growing, I just wrote about this for the April newsletter actually, that things are that, like the cells of our body before we were even an embryo, just a couple of cells. It's just like shaking with life, but nothing's happening other than that. It's just there. And then suddenly it's 8 cells instead of 4. And then... Thank you for listening.